You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Welcome, everyone. We are delighted to have New York Times columnist David French with us. David, welcome, and welcome to Asbury.
Well, it's so great to be here. Thanks for having me. And you've got a great NPR podcasting voice.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. You've been on campus. You were in chapel earlier today, and we've talked a bit. And one of the things I'm interested in asking you is about Christians in the media.
Mm-hmm.
How do we become part of the solution in a polarized culture rather than part of the problem, which you've indicated has been the case?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a lot of it depends on what is it that you believe your job is if mm-hmm. you're in the media. And one thing that we have found is that a lot of people seem to view their role in the media as they are almost like lawyers representing a client. In other words, my job is to represent the views of my side. That's a poisonous view. It's a poisonous, especially poisonous if you have it in hard news reporters. But it's a poisonous view even if you're talking about the kind of job that I do, which is I'm a columnist, I'm an opinion columnist. And so what a lot of people want to have happen is they want to see their views reflected in the people that they read. And so they almost want to view columnists is almost like lawyers, as they're lawyers for the taking on and taking down the other side. And that gets really poisonous because as soon as your writing, your reporting, your journalism becomes cause-oriented, it stops being fundamentally truth-oriented. And one of the best ways I've heard my job described is my dispatch colleague, Jonah Goldberg, said, "My job's to tell the truth as best as I can see it. We're not perfect. We don't know everything. We don't know all of the facts all the time. We try our best. But our job is fundamentally to tell the truth as best as we can discern the truth." And when you put that as your job, as job number one, it really is clarifying and provides sort of it becomes like the North Star for all that follows. But we have way too many people in the media who believe essentially their job is to be the lawyer for their readers. And that's very dangerous. Especially over time, what ends up happening is you cultivate a readership that is sort of immune to any perspective from the other side, is always looking to you to make them feel better about their choices and their decisions, to make them feel better about their political leaders. And it's helping create this partisan polarization negative feedback loop that we're in today.
If we disregard objectivity, as some in the mainstream media advocate for, the former president or current president of CBS News, former editor of the Washington Post, wrote an article a couple of years ago that said we should do away with objectivity, that the truth is just the truth as you see it if you're a hard news reporter. That seems to me to be dangerous.
Oh, it's incredibly dangerous. Although I think that they would say, in some ways, this debate, they're talking past each other. So way they would frame it is they would say, no, what we're really going after is this sort of mindless both sidesism that essentially says, okay, if somebody says X and somebody says Y, our job is to report that somebody said X and somebody said Y, not to adjudicate in any way the relative truthfulness of the various claims, for example. So what they'd say is we want fairness and perspective. But if you're – anytime you're moving away from, again, as your North Star, let's say you're a hard news reporter, I want to know what happened. I want to know the events as they occurred. When you're moving away from that as your North Star and you're putting in something else where the report has some other objective or there's some other goal with the reporting other than describing the truth of the matter, you're really starting to walk a dangerous road.
You said something at lunch, and yes, we did feed David while he was here, despite the fact that I left you stranded before lunch, but we won't get into that.
That's fine.
I did get him there eventually. You talked about fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And the dangers of fandom, I guess, and that applies to the media as well as just the public, Christians especially. Can you talk a little bit about how the dangers of fandom?
Yeah. So what we're seeing happen in American politics is American politics in many ways are starting to mirror American celebrity culture, which shouldn't surprise anybody because, you know, we just had a celebrity president. Mm-hmm. And it's a porous barrier between celebrity life and politics. There's a lot of, you know, cross-pollinization. And so what we're starting to see is people treating politicians in many ways the way we have traditionally treated pop stars or athletes. You become a fan of a politician. You start stanning them, you know, to use like Gen Z language or whatever. You're a fan of the person. And what ends up happening when you become a fan of the person, once again, that sort of the truth is your North Star starts to dissolve and melt away in favor of supporting your hero or your heroine. And so that means how do you support somebody you really like? Well, you amplify when they're right and the things that they do that are good. And if they do something that's bad, you ignore it or you minimize it. Again, this is – I used to keep using the analogy to lawyers. That's what lawyers do. If you are in a court case, you can count on your lawyer – to make everything that's good about you very good and to make everything that's bad about you basically meaningless and to try to win over a jury. And this is what we tend to do with politicians. We try to, if we support one, we make everything that's good about them very, very good. And anything that's bad about them, we don't want to hear it. Or if we hear it, we want to minimize it or rationalize it rather than just taking everything as it is and making judgments based on things as they are. We continually want to move to the world as we want it to be. You know, and honestly, Christians should be more protected from that instinct, but I fear that we're less. I fear that we have a major celebrity culture in Christianity. But we should be more immune from that. Our theology teaches us there's exactly one perfect human being who's ever existed. It's Jesus. Everyone else has fallen. Everyone else is flawed. But with our faith in Christ, the one perfect person, then everyone else has fallen. Everyone else is flawed. They'll let us down in some way. Jesus Christ will not let us down. And so we should be immune, not, you know, we're human. We're not going to be immune. But we should have antibodies against sort of fan worship, hero worship, fan service, all of this stuff. But sadly, a lot of the evangelical community right now is very, very, very much a celebrity-driven culture. And that starts to make us part of the problem and not part of the solution.
You touched on three themes during your talk in chapel: love, power, soundness of mind, right? And you told a great story about somebody with whom you had befriended while you were serving abroad, and you were couldn't have been more different.
Yeah.
Spiritually, theologically, and yet you form this bond. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So this happened in the fall of 07. I volunteered to go to Iraq, and I joined the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. This is in the surge. And I was a reserve officer replacing an active duty JAG officer who couldn't deploy. And I was the only reservist. Everyone else had trained together, lived together for years, part of a team. I was a late arrival, coming from a reserve unit. A lot of active duty soldiers tend to look down on reservists as maybe less well trained. So I'm feeling very, very alone when I land in October 22nd, 2007 at our base in Iraq. And there was one person who wasn't just ready for me to arrive, but literally ready to be my friend. And it's my friend Leo, who, as I said in the chapel talk, we were different and are different. I'm white, evangelical, Southern conservative. He is a Mexican-American naturalized citizen who is a former Mormon, former Catholic, who now calls himself an agnostic, who worships the Hubble Space Telescope because it sees further than any human. And he's very funny. And we form this bond. We form a bond. And where we were inseparable in Iraq, I would trust him with my life. And the reason why I told that story is because that relationship, which is so meaningful to me and so meaningful to, you know, to both of us, those kinds of relationships, which are tangible manifestations of our love for our neighbor, our love for our community, our love for each other, are diminishing in this country. It's not just that people have fewer friends across ideologies or faiths. We just have fewer friends, period, now. And so one of the things I did not get to in the chapel talk, because it was very short, is that this loss of friendship, this social isolation, is contributing to political radicalization. Because what we found is that people who register a low sense of belonging, whether it's at work, in their home, or amongst a friend community, are disproportionately attracted to authoritarian politics. And when you think it through, it makes a lot of sense, because somebody who lacks a sense of belonging in their community, in their church, in their home, often is missing both relationships and purpose. And so what do they find in radical political movements? They certainly find purpose. They're, you know, revolutionary. They're draining the swamp. They're doing whatever. And then they also find relationships, the other people who want to drain the swamp with them. And one of the best pieces of journalism that our my colleagues at the Dispatch did was my colleague Andrew Egger did a long piece on the front row Joes. The front row Joes are the people who go to every Trump rally. Like, they're on the front row. They follow Trump like they follow the Grateful Dead. And he said they came for Trump. They stayed for each other. So Trump was the initial attractor. But they stayed in this community because they loved each other. And so they had walked together through things, you know, through cancer diagnosis. It's been years. We've had years and years of Trump rallies now. So they've spent years and years together. They've walked together through job losses. They've walked together through grandchildren's births, through cancer diagnosis. You know, they've been through a lot together. And the reality is that sense of community is really what binds them more than the ideology. And one of the things that we miss all the time is when we're talking about, say, let's say we think a certain politician is dangerous or a certain ideology is dangerous. We think if we just tell people the politician is bad or tell people the ideology is flawed, then they'll just go, oh, thank you for setting me straight. Because the reality is you're saying, hey, by the way, you're wrong and you should lose all your friends.
Yes.
And that's a tough sell. That's a tough sell. So one of the ways in which we can ease the political crisis in this country quite literally is through friendships. No joke, no exaggeration. If we had better friendships in this country, we would have a lower political temperature in this country.
Are we failing as Christians to seek out friendships with people who don't believe what we believe?
Yes, sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, you can't make somebody be your friend. Mm-hmm. So there are times when people are not going to respond to you in a favorable way. And that's okay. I mean, you try. But the fact of the matter is it is very, very easy right now in this country to fall into factional friendships. A couple of things are happening at once. One is we're in the middle of something called the Big Sort. And the Big Sort means that more Americans live with people of like mind than any time we've been measuring the statistic. So more Americans are living in what are called landslide counties, where one side or the other wins by 20 points or more in a presidential race. So a bunch of us just live in very red or very blue parts of the country. So you don't necessarily even come across people of different political points of view. So it becomes very difficult to say, well, even if you wanted to have these cross-ideological friendships, where do you go? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then, of course, culture builds on top of that. So the more you spend in one part of America, in one culture, the further you are from relating to people in another part of America. I've put it like this. Let's suppose you are a 25-year-old guy from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, mm-hmm. and you're visiting in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and there's another 25-year-old guy right next to you in the elevator in Park Slope. There's a very good chance that you have almost nothing in common. Mm-hmm. There's a very good chance that you don't watch the same television, you don't listen to the same podcast, you don't listen to the same music, you don't attend the same church. You're like living in different countries. And the more that we become like that, the harder it becomes to make those relationships. But we have to, but the more polarized we become, the more imperative it becomes to have those relationships. So they're becoming more valuable and more difficult simultaneously.
So we have a bunch of media students here, mm-hmm. students who will go into journalism. What's the best advice you can give them as they approach this profession in 2024?
Yeah, so the single best piece of advice that I can give you at an early stage in your career is become an expert in something, mm-hmm. okay? Number one, if you're 22 or 23, nobody cares about your takes. Like, you might be able to find some people, if you're particularly witty or cutting or whatever, who like to hear you write your takes. But it's not because you're challenging them. It's just because you're saying what they already believe in a funny or amusing way. No, where you can distinguish what we need, we don't need more takes. And I don't say this just because I don't want the competition. But we're overrun with attitude. Mm-hmm. We're undercovered with knowledge. And so one of the things that I have told young journalists is learn a subject really well, and you will become valuable, if not indispensable. How many young reporters are conversant in Israel-Palestine at a deep level? Mm-hmm. How many young reporters are conversant in the military tactics of Ukraine versus Russia? How many reporters are really truly conversant in monetary policy? So use your brain and your opportunities as a student to become knowledgeable, not to develop an attitude, but to develop knowledge. And commit yourself to that, because what I have found is there is a quality deficit in American journalism. I'm very grateful to work with some of the best journalists around at the mm-hmm. Times, but there is a quality problem. And a lot of the trust problem is related to the quality problem, not just a bias problem, but a quality problem. And you can distinguish yourself if you know what you're talking about, if you know crucially who are the right people to talk to get answers, and if you're committed to accuracy and fairness. You know, I would give the exact same advice to the most secular media, journalism student as I give the most religious journalism student. Job one is be good at your job. Mm-hmm. That's job one, be good at your job. And I wish we would tell that to more Christian young people who are, when we talk about the challenges of their career, job one is to be good at your job. And a lot of the adversity that people experience and a lot of the problems that people experience professionally are not related to their faith.
Right.
It's related to they're not good at their job.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I think, at least from my perception, young journalists believe their biggest barrier is going to be their faith or the lack of acceptance of their faith in secular media.
No.
And it's really just a matter of being good at their job.
Be good at your job. I'm not going to say that there's nobody who faces problems because of their beliefs or whatever. And I mean, you've seen public cancellations, you've seen public controversies, but that is not the dominant culture of media in the United States. We do have a problem in that we do have a lot of young journalists with hot takes, mm-hmm. and they're just bad. Like, and then they say, well, why am I not getting ahead? Like, why do I not have more fame and notoriety, et cetera? Well, you haven't earned it. Like, you haven't mm-hmm. earned it. Now, I know it's not always high-quality people who get fame and notoriety. Like, a lot of low-quality people have fame and notoriety. But they've often done that and achieved that by, feeding the beast of American animosity and polarization. There's a different path. There's a better path. And the single best thing that you can do as a Christian in the media is just to be good at your job. And also, Christians should not think for 5 seconds that Christian media can be less challenging to your Christianity than secular media. Mm-hmm. I think the most difficult place to be a Christian in the United States of America is within a broken Christian institution. That is the most difficult. It is far more difficult than being the only Christian or one of very few Christians in a secular environment. It is far more difficult to be in a Christian institution that is disobedient, because what happens is your obedience is viewed as apostasy. Your obedience and your faithfulness is viewed as betrayal. And you will find yourself alienated from fellow believers, which is much harder than being alienated from people who don't share your values. So you'll find yourself feeling alienated from fellow believers, cast out of your own community, when you are a faithful Christian in a faithless institution. And that, to me, is a much bigger danger for young Christian professionals than the idea that a secular workplace just doesn't want to work with you or hire you.
The notion that I'm going to be rejected because of my faith, or not accepted as a professional because of my faith, seems to be, and we have anecdotal evidence at least to support this, seems to be largely a myth. As you say, I mean, not everyone is going to be welcome to or want to be witnessed to.
Yeah.
But there's this hostility that is perceived really is not there in most cases.
In most cases, no. Now, there are anecdotes that are different, and I don't diminish that at all. And I have worked on legal cases in my legal career where I defended people who were persecuted because of their religious faith, or maybe persecuted as a bit strong term. They were denied a job because of their religious faith, or denied a promotion. And I took those cases, and by God's grace, we won the cases. But what's interesting is how few of them there are. So if you set on one side the number of successful cases, or cases at all, dealing with religious discrimination against evangelicals denying work opportunities, and compare it with the number of cases brought by Black Americans and the number of successful cases brought by Black Americans regarding race discrimination and employment, even now, 60 years after the Civil Rights Act, there is infinitely more racial discrimination in work and employment going on than there is religious discrimination. Just, it's not even the same category. And yet a lot of Christians think, I'm going to be disadvantaged because of my faith. Again, there are individual stories and there are individual institutions that do that, yes. But will that be the dominant characteristic of your median Christian college student? No. No, absolutely not.
And isn't there a failing there of the news business because it'll take one of those incidents, highlight it, and make it seem like the norm, right?
Right. Right, it absolutely will. And again, these are real incidents. And so we do need to have the legal protections that do exist. And we should avail ourselves of the legal system when we have meritorious reasons to do it. That was most of my career doing that. But at the same time, telling young Christian college students that they're going to face some kind of implacable hostility out there, I think is doing people a real disservice. Because it's kind of making them move into the marketplace in a bit of a defensive crouch. It's pre-closing them off to their neighbors. And then it's also creating a kind of the way we flip around the word persecution, like you saw me almost do it.
Yes.
It's almost like stolen valor. You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
you know,
because
if you're looking at the apostles, if you're looking at the early church, that was persecution.
Yes.
Torture, death, you know, beatings. At the early church, a beating was persecution. In the 21st century, a tweeting is considered persecution. They're not the same thing.
Right.
And so we need to stop labeling adversity or annoyance or inconvenience as persecution, because it's actually kind of bad for us, because it gives us a false sense of our own heroism. sort of a more heroic story about ourselves than might be necessary or proper. And so I do think there's – and then it creates this kind of good versus evil picture of struggle that much of life doesn't fall so neatly into. And, you know, and in many of the cases that I've worked on where Christians did face real, you know, challenges in the workplace, what was interesting to me was the institution, the universities – we're not saying, yeah, we did this and we're proud of it because they're Christian. A lot of it was we were fighting over whether that was the reason for the job action in the first place.
Right.
So they were not saying, yeah, no Christians allowed. They're saying, no, we do not discriminate against Christians. And we're trying to prove that, in fact, they did. And so it's not the case that there's this dominant tone in American workplaces that's, you know, faithful Christians need not apply.
Let's talk, before we get out of here, talk a little bit about your job right now with the New York Times. What do you see as your role as a columnist in this broader public discussion?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, I go back to that job description of Jonah, to tell the truth, okay? However, I'm not sitting here just writing about anything and everything. I have a specific life experience. I have specific areas of expertise in law and in dealing with, armed conflict, the law of armed conflict. I have enormous experience in constitutional litigation. And also as a result of a lot of my life experiences and a lot of my study into the challenges of American polarization, another thing I write a lot about is human connection. Mm-hmm. And so I have a kind of a couple of mandates. One mandate is I don't stray out of my mandate. Okay. One of the fastest ways for anybody to lose credibility is to start trying to talk authoritatively about something they don't know very much about. Mm-hmm. And so you're not going to see me write about monetary policy. You're not going to see me really write about Social Security reform. Those are not my areas of expertise. And if I open my mouth about monetary policy and someone who's listening who knows monetary policy will hear me say something wrong, that's going to cause them to doubt everything that I say, right? And so one part of my mandate is don't stray out of my mandate. But then the other one is when I am in and when we are talking about those ideas that I have experience in, it's just to tell the truth without fear or favor. In other words, I don't sugarcoat the truth or the reality if it's critical of my own team. I don't punch twice as hard if it's against the other team just because my team will like it, right? No, you try to tell the truth. And you try to give people the tools to help them discern the truth themselves. And so, for example, right after October 7th, when Hamas attacked Israel, I wrote a long piece about drawing on my experience serving as a JAG officer in Iraq. Here's what the laws of war are. Here's how Hamas is violating them. Here's going to be the ways in which Israel is going to face its own challenges regarding the laws of war. You're going to hear a lot of contentious statements, but here's the framework for thinking through what's true and what's not true. So I really tried to give my audience the tools to think through for themselves the next several months of the war. Mm-hmm. So again, if I had a kind of a lawyer view, it would have been because my sympathies are with Israel in this conflict would be if it was the lawyer kind of view, everything you'd hear from me would be nothing but praise for Israel and nothing but condemnation for Hamas. Mm-hmm. When Israel's not perfect, mm-hmm. right? And so telling the truth as best as I can, helping give my readers the tools to discern the truth, those are core job descriptions.
There is a price, though, sometimes for telling the truth. And you've experienced that firsthand. You've dealt with a lot of criticism for the positions you've taken, right?
Oh, gosh. Criticism is fine.
I guess that's a tame word for what you've experienced.
Cyber harassment, death threats, people coming to the house, bomb scares. I mean, we've had the FBI at our house. We've been in contact with Tennessee Homeland Security. We've had sheriffs, had to call the sheriffs, more than once. We've had a clumsy swatting attempt years ago. Like, it's been unbelievable. And part of it is rooted in the reality that, and much of it has come from my own quote-unquote side, in the sense that people, I'm a conservative, so you would be broadly considered on the right. And the most vicious attacks against me, I've had some pretty bad ones come from the left, but the most vicious and dangerous have come from the right. And part of it is over this sense of betrayal. Like, you're supposed to represent us. You're supposed to be, if we choose Trump, you're supposed to tell the rest of the world why that was a good choice. If we choose to not support Ukraine, your job is to tell the rest of the world why that's a good choice. If we choose not to accept the COVID vaccine, your job is to tell. And so, but what if I disagree? What if I want to, what if I support Ukraine? What if I believe the COVID vaccine was life-saving? What if I your job, your role, and unless you fulfill that role, you're a Benedict Arnold, you're a traitor. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting, that dynamic where the most hostility is reserved for the in-group dissenter is a warning bell for serious political violence. So if you look historically at revolutionary violent movements, one of their first targets are the in-group dissenters. So the people who would be ostensibly on their side but aren't all the way committed or might disagree a little bit, you got to sweep them out. You have to either pull them in or crush them to clear the decks to take on the other side. And so there are people who are experts in civil conflict who have begun to pull some of their resources from, like, the Baltic states. The Balkan states, and bring them back home to deal with some of the same issues that have popped up in America that they saw popping up in, like, the old Yugoslavia before it fell apart in violent, mm-hmm. nearly genocidal warfare. And one of those things is they're beginning to see the fury against the in-group dissenter or the in-group moderate. And you see it on the left as well. The far left gets much angrier at left liberal dissenters than it does at the right. And the far right gets much angrier at sort of like never Trump dissenters than it does at the left. And this is all part of that. When you're building almost a revolutionary style movement, you start hunting for heretics big time.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask at least one more political question.
And sure.
You just touched on the danger. What do you see happen in this next election cycle?
I see the next election cycle being incredibly tense, probably violent to some degree, and I don't know the outcome. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, I think if the election were held today, Donald Trump would win, but that's an irrelevant question because the election isn't today, you know. So what will the state of the country be? What will be the health of these two men? What will be the state of the war in Israel? What will be the state of the war in Ukraine? There's so many variables that we just can't say with any confidence. And I would take with a grain of salt any confident declaration about what's going to happen because, you know, I've listened to some of the smartest people and political analysts out there, and I've seen diametrically opposed answers as to who will win in 2024 from equally smart people. And what that tells me is it's kind of up for grabs right now.
Well, we will leave it there. David French, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. This is a real pleasure.
Pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.